This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, case 149. Zhuefeng's rice field, the main case. One day, Master Zhuefeng said to the assembly, "What we're talking about is like a rice field. It's dependent upon the people plowing the fields and planting the seeds. Do not miss receiving this gift." Zhuangzi said, "Then what is the rice field itself?" Zhuefeng said, "Look." Zhuangzi said, "Although what you say is correct, I wouldn't say it that way." Zhuefeng said, "How would you say it?" Zhuangzi said, "One by one, each and every person." The commentary. Those lost in the mundane seek solace in the sacred. This is because they've not yet, as yet, understood the sacred matter of ordinary household activity. The wholehearted practice of the way simply has no edges. It is because the truth of life is beyond existence and non-existence that there is plowing the fields, planting the seeds, and thus a rice field. Indeed, it is because of this gift of activity that one's own self has come into being. Capital verse. The buildings and the grounds protect the Dharma and bring peace to all. The song in the 10 directions grows in wisdom and compassion. How this comes to us is a gift we should not miss. I earlier in the week brought up a koan that also involved Zhuefeng and Zhuangzi, their teacher and student, Zhuefeng, the teacher of Zhuangzi, and they were very close together, said that they were almost like peers, and that he helped to Zhuefeng to build his place of practice, his monastery, before he went off and established another place. This koan, it begins as though we're in the middle of a conversation. What we're talking about is like a rice field. It's dependent upon the people plowing the fields and planting the seeds. It's like we're having an ongoing conversation all the time, intimate communication. What we're talking about is a path of liberation. What we're talking about is the fundamental universal experience that life, in every thing that we touch and experience, holds the seeds of our disappointment and dissatisfaction. It also holds the seeds of our awakening and our liberation. What we're talking about is that everything is impermanent and we are all aging and falling ill at various times and will eventually die. What we're talking about is how do we live this life, and which means how do we live it together and how do we live it with that one, the one on your seat. So for all of these centuries, all of these teachings, all of these places of practice, practices that we've been given, sanghas, forms of teaching, similes, metaphors, analogies, what we're talking about here is like a rice field, Zhuefeng says. How do we talk about that which has no form, that is not fixed, that can't be defined? Why in the Heart Sutra, this pivotal teaching, does it present Prajnaparamita as what it's not? Why does it not definitively say what it is? How do we talk about this? He says it's like a rice field, and so that's why Buddhism has so many ways of trying to, in our mind, create a kind of a picture, a landscape, something that we can relate to. And it's like, oh, it's like that. It isn't that, but it's like that. And then having been given that, now we have to throw that away. Because the just the sense of it is the message. So not to hold on to the container. It's like a rice field, dependent upon the people plowing the fields and planting the seeds. We should not miss receiving this gift. So if it's like a rice field, it, but a nature, self-nature, the source of this gift of activity that brings one's own self into being, then how can it be dependent upon anything? I spoke about this the other day. The Buddha said, fundamental teaching, all conditioned existence is dukkha. Anything that is brought into being comes apart. That's its nature. We see that in every moment when we're sitting. We see that in every moment whenever we are aware of what's in front of us. So what kind of dependency is this? That's why the Buddha, in his own search and studying with different teachers within different communities, learning different forms of meditation, having different experiences in his mind and within his state of meditation that had impacted how he was experiencing himself in the world, kept moving on or not staying within those communities because he realized what he had been taught and what he was experiencing was conditioned. That whatever state, whatever degree of freedom or insight that he was gaining was based on something that he had to keep doing. That was a result, it was dependent upon something. And so he knew, because he was brilliant, because he already had wisdom within him that was guiding him, he knew that that was not going to ultimately be his release, that it had to not be dependent. And so to really understand what that means in terms of our practice, that when we try and induce a controlled state, right, of mindfulness or of equanimity or whatever we think we're supposed to be experiencing, you know, by a force of will, you know, that even if we achieve it, and people give voice to this, they see this in their own processes of discovering what practice actually is, that they might achieve a certain state of quiet or stillness or freedom of thought, but it's brittle, it's fragile. They can't sustain it. And as soon as they get off the cushion, it comes apart. That was very much my experience early on when I was definitely trying to create the state that I thought was what practice was about. And it was almost that the strength of that experience was followed by the strength of its coming apart. And I remember thinking, what's going on? Why is that happening? Why doesn't this continue? And so that Zazen is always, practice is always about, that's why, you know, when I talk about the tension between wakefulness and relaxation, that relaxation is not our normal sense of just kicking back, right? And not doing anything. This is non-doing within a state of wakefulness. And that's not a state that most of us are acquainted with. And so when we concentrate, we get tense. When we relax, we get sleepy. And so what is that natural, original state, unproduced, and yet is the result of the effort of relaxing the activity of samsara, the activity of our habits, of our mental conditions. That's the induced state that we're trying to release ourselves from. And so this analogy is like a rice field, plowing the fields, planting the seeds. makes sense to us because it's like, oh, good, I get to do something, right? I can get busy, because I know how to get busy, right? Just give me something to do, right? And then I'll have done it, right? And then I'll have that thing that doing it will get me. And so we do know how to grow rice. We have to prepare the field. We have to plant the seeds, and then we have to nourish them, make sure that there's water, shade, sun, temperature within, you know, allowable ranges, and then we have a harvest. And that there is, within that soil, there's an intense growing season, and then there are periods where it kind of pulls back. It's still working, right? It's still a rice field, but it's a different level of activity. And so we could think of that as sekshin, and then returning home, or ongo, and then summer and winter training periods. And so that we can think of the path this way, that we make certain conditions that are fertile for bringing forth the seed that has already been planted within us with birth, the seed of our humanity, the seed of our morality, the seed of our wanting our life to be meaningful and to be in contact with it, to be alive within our lives. Those seeds are all there. And so we nourish those conditions, right? We water, sun, and shade those seeds, and day by day, it grows, it gets stronger. And just like with planting seeds in the garden, we can encourage it, we need to encourage them, but we can't force it. We can't say, you know, I'm hungry, so like, give me the rice now, in time for dinner. That's not the way it works, right? We're working, we don't grow the seed. We nurture it. We don't enlighten our mind. We nurture that seed, that enlightened mind that's already present. It's not a force of will. It has its own life force, its own wisdom and intelligence. It's not apart from us, and so we're completely responsible, but it's not me, and it's not you. It has to grow in accord with its nature. A monastery is like this, a sangha is like this, sesshin is like this. We encourage it day by day, day by day. And so as that soil becomes more fertile, the sprouts become strong and vibrant and resilient so that they can withstand fluctuations in sun and shade and temperature. So when there's a fierce storm, right, they can withstand that. They might bend, they might, if it's too strong, then it might take their life, right? But then they come back next season. And then when the time is right, the fruit appears. And when the time is right, the fruit drops. And so, do not miss receiving this gift. So we can understand that analogy. But that's not what Yue Feng's talking about. It's there. It's there in his analogy. You know, it's like the nature of giving, dana paramita. Everyone understands the language of a gift in every culture. I'm assuming that in every culture, I haven't been in every culture, not by a long shot, but I'm assuming that all peoples understand on some level the nature of giving. It's a universal language. And so we can all understand this language. We can understand this analogy. It makes sense to us. And it does give us a sense of, okay, what is the path I need to, what do I need to do? How do I translate that into Buddha Dharma? But when he says, do not miss receiving this gift, is he talking about the rice? Is he talking about the planting? The plowing the field? What is the gift? And to help, Xuanzi says, okay, but what is the rice field itself? And Xuefeng says, look. Just that, look. And Xuefeng says, or Xuanzi says, I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is true, but I wouldn't say it that way. And Xuefeng says, how would you say it? And Xuanzi says, one by one, each and every person. It's like when a student comes in and presents their understanding. And I say, say it another way. Say it another way. Because what that does is it helps us to clarify it more and more and see it, perhaps from a different perspective. It's the power of language and mind. One by one, each and every person. But what is the field itself? What is the gift that we might miss receiving? So Dada Roshi speaks about it in terms of sacred and mundane. When we don't understand, then those lost in the mundane, when we're lost in the busyness, the activity, the samsara of our lives, we seek solace in the sacred, right? In spiritual practice, in zazen, in the teachings, in seshin, in a monastery, going to the mountain. He says this is because we haven't as yet understood that the sacred matter of ordinary household activity. What is the way? Zha Zhao asked Nanquan. Nanquan said, ordinary mind. And Zha Zhao said, should I direct myself to it? Nanquan could have said, look. But he said, instead, if you direct yourself towards it, you move away from it. In directing ourselves towards the sacred, we move away from it. In trying to find meaning in the mundane by seeking it elsewhere, we move away, in a sense, from everything. So Dada Roshi says, the wholehearted practice of the way simply has no edges. So in the world of infinite edges and boundaries and differences, how do we understand this? Xuefeng says, look. And Dada Roshi's footnote says, he has taken in everything. Everything is taken in. There's nothing that isn't encompassed. There's nowhere this does not reach. And then his footnote says, miss receiving this gift. Dada Roshi says, thus we bow to each other. We bow to each other. That's what's happening when we bow to each other, to not miss receiving this gift. This too reaches everywhere, all the way in and down, all the way out and beyond. And because we so often do miss receiving this gift, Dada Roshi teaches, those lost in the mundane seek solace, seek that which seems to be missing in the sacred. And so session is ending. It's time to go back home, almost. Family, friends, work, responsibilities. So where does session end? Where is session? Where is practice? When we talk about it all the time. You know, it's time to practice. When do you practice? Oh, I do it in the morning. How long do you sit? Oh, I sit for an hour. And so in that, there's truth. We're speaking a simple truth, but we're also, in a subtle way, creating edges and boundaries. What happens after that? When does Zazen end? When does it begin? Where does practice occur? Where does it not occur? This is the great boundary that we're trying to dissolve. And that is mirrored by every other boundary. that we create. And so when Zhuangzi says, one by one, each and every person, the rice field itself, plowing the field is the rice field. Planting the seed is the rice field. But what is the rice field? Look. We could begin each period of Zazen rather than with three bells. Is the monarch, or she could just call out, look! Could you hear the vacuum cleaner in the Doksan room? I wondered if you could hear, somebody's zafu kind of exploded. And so we were cleaning up the mess, and I thought, they must be thinking, whoa. This is some serious shit that's got to get cleaned up here. Everybody wants to see who's coming out after that. Extraordinary skillful means. One by one, each and every person. In this one moment, one universe, one suchness, self fallen away, look. Everything taken in, just this. That this is not isolation. Each one plowing the field, this is not busy. Each one contains the whole universe. How do the buildings and grounds protect the Dharma and bring peace to all? What does ensure that the Sangha in the Ten Directions grows in wisdom and compassion? This is our work. This is the work of Dharma study, of practice, of living a life in non-duality. And so in our ordinary work, what we call our everyday work, we have work to do. We have responsibilities, things that need to be accomplished. We have people that we work with, that we have to relate to. We have circumstances that we have to be responding to. And that allows us to provide for ourselves, for others. It hopefully gives us a meaningful way of serving, of contributing, offering something, just like ants and birds and worms and trees. Everything is giving and receiving, right? All the rest of the world never misses the gift it's receiving. It is the gift. And being the gift, it offers the gift, and we receive it. We're that too. Giving and receiving is non-dual. Work is a way to very consciously do that, right? We don't necessarily always think of it that way, but that's the way we think of it as Dharma practitioners. That's why when the workmaster, when Zuisei calls out your name and you're bowing, thus we bow. That I don't miss receiving this gift. Thank you for giving me a way, this way, to offer, to give. Thank you for recognizing that I am that gift. And to do that, we have to develop our skills so we can make our gift a true giving. We have to clarify our intention, which also means knowing what we're doing. To consider our impact, because our impact hopefully is helpful, and very often it is also hurtful in certain ways. Things are so interdependent. And so what is it in Dharma practice? What is our work? What are we serving? What are the skills that we need to develop? Where are the boundaries in our ordinary everyday work between sacred and mundane? You You know, I remember when in early in my training when Dada Roshi would talk about practice of the breath, which was what I was practicing at the time. And he would say that this practice is complete. In this practice, you can develop samadhi, you can realize your self nature. And that was so important for me to hear, because otherwise I might have thought, oh, this is like I'm in the kiddie pool, right? Because this is what beginners practice. And I want to get to the deep end. I want to be doing flips off the board, right? And he helped me to see it more accurately, more clearly. And what that helped me to do was then empower that practice, because otherwise I would disempower it, right? Because this isn't the whole thing. This isn't, you know, this is just waiting. And he helped me to see that, no, I'm not waiting for anything. This is it. I came here asking to receive. Am I missing receiving the gift? How do we perpetuate unhappiness and hindrance for ourselves and others if we are to practice ceasing from harm and practicing good? How do we bring this to life? One of the things that I want to do in the Anga, which I'll talk about in more detail next week, is we're studying Buddha ancestry. And this really began as a kind of a whisper of a idea, of an impulse, because Hojin Sensei and I are going to be going to India on a pilgrimage with some other Sangha members, both from our Sangha here and then also from some our Sangha in New Zealand, because it was initiated by one of our students who's led pilgrimages in India for many years. And so I thought, one, we're going to be away for 3 weeks, and so how do we sort of factor that into the Anga, and then this pilgrimage, which unfortunately everyone isn't going to be able to go on together. But so I was thinking about India and ancestry, and I thought, let's study Buddha ancestors. And so the material that we've made available is the Jataka tales and the stories of the Buddha's previous births and the Theragata, the songs of the women disciples of the Buddha, female disciples. Some of the narratives of some of the male disciples of the Buddha, as well as the female disciples. But then as I continued to think about it, you know, I wanted to look at it in terms of ancestry, you know, because we're all here because of ancestors. But also, how do we know of our ancestors? We know them through stories that are told, and which we take as more or less historical, depending on the nature of the tale itself, depending on the teller of that tale, depending on our trust in the teller of that tale, or how critically minded we might be, of how truthful it might be. But those stories are central and pivotal. I mean, we are storytellers. That's what we do, right? How many of you are going to leave from the session and tell stories about it, right? That's what we do. And stories are amazing. They're incredible, right? But they can also be very deceptive, right? Within every story, there's usually some truth, but there's also some non-truths. You know, scientists who studied memory, you know, prove that the more we remember something, the less true it is, right? The more we change it with every remembering of that thing, the more it becomes not what happened. And so in these memories, these remembrances of these ancestors, you know, what is the intention behind the story? What are we receiving? Because they're so essential, you know, in a sense. Otherwise, there's no vessel, there's no vehicle, right, other than communicating, how did we get here, right? Otherwise, there is not a tradition. There's just, oh, I don't know what there is. Like, what is a storyless gathering? But because those stories, and so we can think of those as narratives, but what is the purpose of those? So if we think back about the rice field, right, there is a cultivated rice field. You plow the soil and you plant the seeds and you nourish them. and there is an uncultivated rice field. Look. We all can see and engage in the cultivated rice field, but what is the uncultivated rice field? One by one, each and every person. There is an ornamented cloud ocean. There is an illuminated cloud ocean. And so in this present moment, in our mindfulness, the self is present. We're aware of our body, sensations, thoughts that might be arising, the temperature of the air, any sounds, the crickets. But also present is our history. The multitudes of narratives, of stories, right, that we have been told, not realizing this is a story. It may be true, it may not be true. And then we become storytellers ourselves. I mean, think of our internal dialogue, a constant narrative. And what is the purpose of that? It creates a sense of continuity. It defines, it describes, it gives us a sense of what is this? Who am I? How did I get here? There are moral aspects to that story. There are truths, there are non-truths. In every story. And so it's kind of interesting to think about how dependent we are upon these stories and how at the same time they convey truth and they also convey delusion. And so if you think of this in terms of practice, you know, as you're going through the field, plowing, when you see things that would obstruct the growth of the plant, a weed, a stone, you tend to it, right, so that it can grow more freely. And so as we're practicing, right, we're not trying to eliminate history, eliminate a memory, because you can't. The seeds are always there. But how do we see them? How true are they? And what's most important is what are the stories that we don't even recognize, the narratives that we don't recognize as narratives, because they're so inculcated. And to think about this in terms of the work that we've been doing, that we're doing and more and more want to be bringing to the Sangha in terms of race, gender, bias, oppression, suffering. So what are the stories that we, as a community, that we as a group of men, a group of women, a group of light-skinned people, a group of dark-skinned people, of a geographical boundary, of a class, these different narratives. And because we are fundamentally moral people, one function of those narratives, those stories, is almost always to make us feel good about who we are. To make us feel like I am that person I want to be. And when the truth of that is not true, when what is actually happening is not that, then that the story has to become even stronger. Right, because the conflict between what I am being told, or what I am, or what I am benefiting from, or what I'm creating, is so painful. Right, it's such a disruption to that sense of who I am that I really have two choices. We as practitioners have two choices. We can either turn towards and take up the revolution of mind, or we can strengthen the story. Tell it again. justify, explain. And so, and this is still, as I'm thinking about this in terms of the ongoing bringing it, you know, into, you know, the teachings and our practice, this is still forming. So I hope this is, has some, makes some sense, because it's still coming together. But to recognize the, you know, what is identity? Identity is the sense of who I am, right? It's what makes me me. It's what makes you you. It's the activity of that, and it's the characteristics that we describe as that. And that's just another word for self. That's what self means, the sense of me, of being. And so, moment by moment, to be examining, seeing the mind arise, is really just seeing all of the different aspects of those narratives, which is just another way of saying all the different aspects of that sense of who I am, my identity, which is just another way of saying the self. To study the way is to study the self. And as I was talking about earlier in the week, to see what is true, what is helpful, what do I encourage, what do I strengthen, what do I nourish? And what is not true? What is not helpful? What do I need to let fall away? What do I not nourish? And how do I do that? How do I see those aspects of that self, of identity, that I don't see? Right? How do I know that I'm dreaming when I'm dreaming? How do I wake up when I'm asleep? James Baldwin said, and he's talking about revolution, and he's talking more in terms of the time when he was writing of Russia and dictators and tyrannies, but it applies here. He says, we should certainly know by now that it is one thing to overthrow one dictator or repel an invader, and quite another thing to really achieve a revolution. So we can try and overthrow our identity as a deluded samsaric person by taking on a new identity of an enlightened Buddhist person. So rather than telling this story, I've got a new story for you. And it's good. I feel very good about it. And I'm sure you will too. He says, time and time again, the people discover that they have merely betrayed themselves into the hands of yet another Pharaoh, who, since he was necessary to put the broken country together, will not let them go. Since that new narrative was responsible for practicing letting go of the old dictator, now it's got the power, right? It doesn't want to be let go of. Perhaps, he says, people being the conundrums that they are and having so little desires to shoulder the burden of our lives, this is what will always happen. But he says, but at the bottom of my heart, I don't believe this. I think that people can be better than this. And I know that people can be better than we are. We are capable of bearing a greater burden once we discover that the burden is reality and we arrive at the place where reality is. Anyway, the point here is that we are living in an age of revolution, whether we like it or not. Thank you. And so, you know, in the early days, one of the questions that came up a lot was, as we were, you know, trying to understand this Dharma, just, you know, at a basic level, was, you know, what does Dharma not address? What can you not attend to in your life in Dharma? And there are different ways of responding to that, but and some skillful and not so skillful. But I think of that in terms of, the Dharma, the Buddha, as I've talked about before, I see as just somebody who went very, he was like a voyager, a pilgrim, who went on a very, very deep, deep journey. And then he came back having realized something universal, fundamental. In a sense, he went beyond the story, beyond the narrative, just as we can. And then he came back to report, but he had to do that by telling stories, right? Because that's what we do. That's how we convey. And that story took, those stories took place in a particular time and place, right? And so part of our job is to see the truth into those and to see what else they might be as well. And so I think of that in relationship to, you know, when we look at this Dharma, at our practice, at our lives, at identity, and we look at it in a way that may seem, well, wait a minute, you know, what does race or gender or racism or sexism or politics or social justice or the environment, climate change, what do these things have to do with the Dharma? And I've talked about this recently, and we will keep talking about this because it's important. Because again, if we don't understand, then we won't empower it. We won't empower that study. So if we don't understand how studying this narrative, that takes this particular lens, like the narrative of whiteness or the narrative of privilege or the narrative of gender, of maleness or femaleness, then I won't engage in that study, and that aspect of myself I won't examine. And to think that if I just do my practice, follow my breath, let go, that I will see that. In a sense, I will see the basis, the fundamental, the principle, but I may make no connection at all between that fundamental, that uncultivated rice field and the cultivated rice field. And so that part of my being, that part of my manifestation will not manifest. I won't harmonize because that's still dark to me. And so that's why we're focusing on these aspects of our world, the environment, racism and sexism, because they're so deeply woven into our being as human beings, as is the earth, and also in terms of our being as human beings, in terms of living at this time and place, in this country, in this culture. And so as part of that, I want to encourage everyone to really take advantage of the resources that are on the Beyond Fear of Differences page. If you go to that website, you'll see resources. There's really incredibly powerful, insightful articles and videos and that are about the stories that have been told and the stories that have not been told, at least not been heard, and that is really important, and I think is really integral to what I'm talking about today. How do we understand who we are? And how do we understand how critical, how essential that is to every single moment of our lives? How I experience, what I see when I open my eyes, what I see when my eyes fall on you and all of the many yous, what I hear and what I don't hear, what is seen and unseen, you know, that passage in the Metta Sutra. You know, the weak and the strong, the great, the mighty and the small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and yet to be born. We We can think of that as all the multitude of sentient beings. We can also think of that as all the beings within ourselves, the seen and the unseen, those living close, those living far away, those that have been born to us, those not yet born. We don't even know it's there. What a wonderful opportunity. And of course, the thing is, when you tell a story, sometimes it changes your whole life. Right? It helps us to see things in a different way. And in that, there's a death. A death to that moment of identity, that sense of self. And that's disruptive by nature. Learning, in a sense, is disruptive. Right? It upsets the place, this place, right? Because it opens us up to something we don't yet know, we don't yet see. Going to a new place we've never been to before, hearing a voice we've never heard before, is in a sense disruptive. And we can experience that as a pleasant thing or as an unpleasant thing. But the more challenging it is, we should ask ourselves, why are some stories so disruptive? Why are some encounters so disruptive? The more disruptive it is, the more in a sense, threatening that identity. Right, which is bad news if we're trying to protect and defend and maintain. But that's not really our path, because there's no awakening there. There's no reclaiming our lives there. And to do this together is Sangha. The buildings and grounds protect the Dharma and bring peace to all. The Sangha in the 10 directions grow in wisdom and compassion. When we are practicing, how this comes to us is a gift we should not miss, which means we have to recognize the gift itself, the cultivated and the uncultivated. So, I hope that we are able to bring this out more during the Ango. So, thank you everybody for this day, and for those of you who are here for Sesshin, and this opportunity to practice together. You know, to live this human life, to encounter this Dharma, and to have the opportunity to open our eyes and our hearts and our minds, it's not a small thing, as Dada Roshi used to say. It's not a small thing.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.